Badmash Company by Tanya Malik. So we got caught. My husband Karamjot walked in and saw us. We could have overpowered him and run. There were three of us and just him. But his arrival caught us by surprise. He was supposed to be at his printing shop. Karamjot's dead mother's silver bowls and jewelry were out on the center table, and I was wrestling the gold-embroidered saris he gave me as a wedding gift into a polythene bag. Standing next to me, Sudhir, my first husband, froze in place with a wad of Karamjot's cash in hand. But it was when Sudhir's brother, Hari, emerged from the bedroom with Karamjot's computer that Karamjot screamed in sudden understanding and ran out. It was an old housing complex in central Delhi, and the front door had a bolt both inside and out. Sudhir ran to the door, but it was too late. Karamjot had bolted the door and padlocked us in. "This motherfucker's the type to call the police," Sudhir said. Now we were out on the streets with two policemen. Most of the time, the men shied away from the embarrassment of calling the police and having the whole colony know that they were duped. They accepted the loss of their belongings, but did not go so far as to publicly accept their loss of face. Other residents stared curiously at us as they emerged onto the street and then shuffled away quickly, lest they become embroiled in the fracas at their doorstep. A rickshawala parked his bike carriage next to us and looked on with interest, finding entertainment while in wait for his next customers. Sudhir and Hari were trying to reason with the senior policeman, who was pointing and jabbing at the brothers, his hips moving as if he were humping Sudhir. It made me smile, and seeing this, the other policeman pulled me by the hair to the wall. Pushing me down to the ground, he told me to wait for the policewoman. "Shameful," he spat a bullet of phlegm that dripped down my forehead like bird shit. The rickshawala slapped his knee and grinned at the policeman, as if his approval was just what the policeman lacked. Karamjot, who had squeezed my bum and kissed my neck, then come back for more before he left for his shop this morning, was holding his head, sobbing squeakily. Karamjot was the type who always wanted to be part of the happening crowd. He wanted people to ask his opinion and advice on matters of business and life. He was our fourth mark, chosen by Hari because he lived by himself in his one-bedroom flat, tended to his shop, and rode his scooter to Temptations Bar twice a week. Hari sniffed out these unsuspecting men and their desolate lives as if he had a compass pin pointing at their location. The scheme went like this. Hari would set up shop as a matchmaker in a neighborhood where enough residents and businesses were crammed into narrow streets so the janta would notice him, but then later forget him just as easily. He covered the walls of his rented space with astral charts and posters of open palms crisscrossed with tricky lines of destiny. His friends would drop in, pretending to be customers, perusing the photo albums of happily married couples, pictures taken surreptitiously by Hari at different weddings all over the district when he worked as a waiter with a catering company. Karamjot did not know he wanted to get married until Hari's purposeful visit to the printing shop to print flyers and booklets for his matchmaking services. When Karamjot at last expressed an interest, Hari, with much ado, slid my picture across the tabletop, past the ink stains and invoices until it was under Karamjit's slender nose. In the photo, I am standing in the shade of a fiery red gulmohar tree. Before Hari took the picture, Sudhir had pulled at my breasts, positioning them so the two mounds rose welcomingly out of the top of my salwar. He turned my face to the side, as if I was demurely looking away from the camera, unaware that my dupatta had slipped to reveal the top of the blouse. Sudhir and I were only married 2 months then. There was no force involved in my marrying Sudhir or agreeing to his and Hari's scheme. We met at a construction site for a house in East Delhi. I hauled cement in metal basins up and down skeletal stairways, while my father cut marble and stone and barely noticed the bricklayer with dark sparkling eyes who smiled at me like he couldn't help it, and who once bent down and gently brushed the gritty wet cement off my rough and cracked bare foot before I ascended. Death came to my father suddenly, and perhaps, as he did not find much in life to be amused about, not undesirably. He was electrocuted while grinding a marble slab, a short circuit due to the hastily patched together wires. I was surprised when I thought I heard my name on his lips as he went to God. But it was not my name, he said, as his skin turned sallow and white. It was the moan that came with the last sucking reflex as the air passed over his vocal cords, a construction worker explained to me. This made more sense. My father often forgot who I was, as if he did not know me since birth. He could walk by me and keep on going without noticing that I was beside him. I was so used to being called girl that my own name was an unfamiliar sound to me until recently. Sudhir helped me take his body to the hospital. He flashed his quick, sweet smile at me in the taxi on our way, and then again at the morgue, my father's crisp body between us. That night I returned to our lean-to, but another family already occupied our room. How they heard of my father, I do not know, and our belongings were gone. These old neighbors gave me blank stares and looked through me as though I was indiscernible in the evening light. I spent the night roaming the murky side roads and with the panicked rats, scurrying, hiding, fleeing at every little noise. There was always my father and me, and I didn't know how to do much beside cook a few dishes and haul cement. At the construction site the next morning, the head contractor bemoaned the loss of work from the day before, but was willing to continue my employment. Only he wanted me to work lying down, not standing up. Sudhir was still there, smiling at me across the half-built walls, and he married me soon after, relieving me of my dilemma of what to do next. Hari came from somewhere up north, moved in with his luggage and his big plan. We used the same story with Karamjot as we used with the men before him. Hari, as a matchmaker, would introduce Sudhir as my brother, fulfilling his parents' dying wish of marrying his sister to a decent man. "She is the reason for my life," Sudhir would tell the man he was handing me off to at the temple. "Take good care of her." And he would smile tremblingly and say to me, "Be a good girl and honor your family always," laying a hand on my head in blessing, when just before the ceremony he took me from front and back, claiming that he would get nothing for the next few months. The scheme was a lucrative one, and it didn't bother us that we needed to move regularly and hastily from place to place. Our investment was a deposit on Hari's matchmaking shop and a few props. Our profit, once I had been married for a few months and possessed keys to Godrej cupboards and intimate family secrets, was everything we made off with and sold from the clothing, the jewelry, the household goods, televisions and stereos, plus the cash, the black money hidden in bedboards and canisters of flour and rice. The brothers and the policemen were still huddled together like they were cold. Sudhir had not looked my way since the police dragged us out of the flat and onto the street. And since no one was paying any attention to me, I dared to shift slightly. My feet were numb from sitting cross-legged on the ground. I tuned in to the indistinct murmur of families conversing with each other and the sound of water draining from kitchen sinks and bathroom buckets. From the tiny balcony of Karamjot's flat, I would watch women load their children into the school van, argue with the vegetable seller about the price of tomatoes and brinjals, and with the municipality sweeper for shifting the dirt from one side of the street to the other. They hung clothes to dry, watered potted tulsi plants, departed in groups for the temple or the market, welcomed husbands home from work. It was better than seeing a movie. I debated with myself if Karamjot, who liked to follow a spicy meal with something sweet, would still eat the rice pudding I had left cooling in the fridge. Hari whispered furtively with the policeman, feeling out how much bribe he would have to fork over. I wondered if he would pay for me too. Karamjot's crying had come to a shuddering end. His grief could be because of his narrow brush with the loss of his belongings, the awareness of his stupidity, or because he felt the sting of my betrayal. Last night, before he fell asleep crooning a wondrous love song in my ear, he told me he appreciated how I moved my hips to accommodate his pumping. Not like the prostitutes, he said, who moved always in the wrong way and sometimes too eagerly. if Hari and Sudhir did not pay the bribe for me, I hoped at least Karamjot might remember this. All of a sudden, as if something had exploded between them, the group broke apart. There was a scuffle, raised voices, and the policemen hauled the handcuffed Hari and Sudhir into their jeep and were pushing a swollen-eyed Karamjot into the vehicle too, shouting that he had to lodge an FIR to go forward with the complaint, and they didn't have all day to stand here arguing. The jeep screeched out of the colony, and the lot of them were gone. I was alone with the smiling rickshawala. He tapped the pedal with his broken slipper and rocked the rickshaw back and forth, humming a film song I had grown to like from the radio.